Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 119, where Sam, Miranda, and Tom are discussing a seminal work drawn from the famous Hawthorne studies, Fritz Roethlisberger and William Dixon's 1939 book, Management and the Worker, published by Harvard University Press. In part two, we examine the author's recommendations and to what extent they have been followed in contemporary times. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. In part one, we actually covered about 95% of what we wanted to say about the book. We went through all of the studies and the development of the methodology and all of the different surprising findings that they had. I did want to just make sure we touch on a little bit more on a couple of things, because it really was interesting to see how they derived the informal organization, which involved several things. It involved how they understood or came to understand the relationships between individuals across occupations, individuals and their supervisors, individuals and I mentioned the interviewer before. They, like, for example, what drove them to help one another versus what presented barriers to helping one another? Because ordinarily in the workplace, helping one another was not actually considered to be a proper thing to do, which I found rather surprising. But there were rules, there were norms that determined when folks within a clique would help one another, they would support one another, do another one's job when necessary, or who played games together. And they found that the cliques that formed in the workplace in the last group, they found that a division, a social division on what people did in their off-work time and how they collected together, that reinforced the work relations. So you can kind of see how in different ways, not just the specific supervisory relationships or occupational relationships or all sorts of other things that caused folks to gravitate towards one another, or in this particular case, how one clique formed in opposition to the other clique, the folks in the front who did the easier of the two jobs, were high performers, against the ones doing the tougher jobs in the back, who were therefore lower performance and then considered as a result lower status. And that division drove a lot of what they would say later as, you know, describing or creating the informal organization and the ideological organization that they covered in the part five.
Yes, they go into, I think it's the last three chapters of part four, that they go into a lot of detail of how they began to kind of uncover and understand and explore the different relationships between types of workers and comparing one group to another. And it's very, I think, very thorough the way they did that. And then they reflect, I think, at least what I found really interesting was this reflection that they do on social control and how they begin to understand, you know, all of these different groups as having internal functions and as having, right, like an effect that it's unique in itself and that then also affects the, what they understand as the external functions in the organization.
I also found quite interesting how it was all very relatable. So there's an attempt to map out the friendship groups and the antagonist groups, but also sort of on a side note, just because I found it quite curious and relatable, the observation that I think it was the window openings or non-openings that was source of conflict. And I think in today's modern office, generally it's the heating, right? The room temperature. For somebody, it's not warm enough, too warm and so on. So to a certain extent, there is something about, you know, those kind of objective factors, but it's not that the factor that impacts the output or the productivity. It's actually sort of that conflict or that sort of getting on together around these things that makes the difference. But again, the level of detail to the context to make it kind of like, you know, you felt you were properly there and you could understand it. It's not something very kind of like abstract or removed. You could properly sense that this is a workplace, and this is the bickering, and this is what they call each other, and these are the games, and this is how they spend their time, and this is who gets on with who. I really enjoyed that interweaving of something relatable, something in the context with kind of broader reflections.
And so based on all of this work, they come to two conclusions at the end, which I think are really fascinating and a great way to segue into, you know, what do we think about this? The two conclusions, and this is in the chapter, the concluding chapter was called Implications for Personnel Practice. Like, this is supposed to be, okay, managers, this is based on all of this work we did. This is what we think you should be doing. Conclusion number one, management should introduce in its organization an explicit skill of diagnosing human situations. The skill should be explicit because the implicit or intuitive skills in handling human problems, which successful administrators or executives possess, are not capable of being communicated and transmitted. An explicit skill, on the other hand, is capable of being refined and taught and communicated to others. In other words, we should have people in the organization dedicated to doing exactly the kind of work that Roethlisberger and Dixon did, to understand, unpack what are workers dissatisfied about and how to address them. Number two, by means of this skill, management should commit itself to the continuous process of studying human situations, both individual and group, and should run its human affairs in terms of what is continuously learning about its own organizations. Okay, so this is not a one-off thing that managers should do. This should be a continuous, should be persistent, should be forever. Do we do either one of these now? As a matter of fact, how far away are we from this 100 years later?
I think it's easier to ask if we know of any organization that does. I don't. And, you know, there's like 1,000 things that I find interesting about this. But I'm going to start with the last one that you kind of brought up on, which is, you know, this idea that we need to continuously do these, like, you know, the management of these kind of human experiences and this very important aspect of the organization is not something that you just figure out and then introduce very cool HR or whatever it's called system into the organization and then, you know, assume that everything, like, you know, that all of these kind of social informal aspects are going to work well. But you need to continuously assess what are the experiences of workers inside the organization, how are they changing, look at the individuals, but also look at the groups within the organization and try to understand what are we learning from the workers, from the people, and then try to formulate, you know, special practices that address these experiences.
Well, I might ask it this way, because there's very clearly a lot of traffic out there about how corporate behaviors, about how organizations are moving away from being concerned about the human situation, the movement to treating employees like individual contractors or some of those sorts of things. But on the other hand, there are plenty of organizations where care of the individual members is still a paramount value or a paramount virtue. And I guess the question is, why is it that we don't see, like, why don't we see more of it, I guess? I'm trying to make a simple question out of something that is a bit complicated.
I mean, there's also something to say about sort of broadly speaking today's world where, you know, people do, especially in certain countries, change job quite sort of regularly. So I presume that starts a cycle where, is it actually worthwhile getting to know these people? How long are they going to stay? Is it actually worthwhile spending time and effort on this? Or are they just going to sort of, you know, move on? Which doesn't explain all of it, but perhaps to a certain extent explains a part where then it just spirals a little bit and all of these, and you get further and further distant from these principles. Then I think there's just sort of a very basic question of, depending on the workplace, are you actually considered, you know, a human being with all its complexity, or just, you know, another factor of production, basically another input which is a sad truth to a lot of workplaces where people are just replaceable and get replaced and are treated as objects to the extreme.
Yes, and I think something that also gets overlooked is you know what they mentioned in the first kind of recommendation of making the skill of diagnosing human situations an explicit skill that management should have. And I don't know to what extent, you know, MBAs and, you know, other kinds of programs that are trying to form managers are, you know, teaching this skill. I know there's some interest in, for example, trying to teach future managers or current managers kind of ethnographic skills. And I assume that, you know, it's trying to get or trying to answer to this need of having this skill of observing. You know, if we go back to the rules of interviewing, which both of you, Miranda and Tom, pointed out that these are just skills for being able to have a conversation and being a good listener. And I don't know, well, I do know, but I don't know to what extent these skills and these rules and these, you know, the skill of listening and observing is understood as something that is very important to be a good manager. Which I would say it's one of the like key things that I would take from this book.
No, that's okay. I mean, it sort of begs a different question, which is, are these skills that can actually be taught or educated or mass trained? I have a lot of public sector experience, and to some extent, a lot of workplace climate training that we receive is oriented on trying to improve the way in which we treat people or the way we consider personnel situations. And certainly throughout my military career, care for the soldiers and care for the dependents was a paramount concern. It was something that we reinforced throughout my professional education. But it's almost like what they're calling for is something that's very professional in its orientation, as you know, a high skill that managers would be able to apply. And to achieve the level of skill in which they're talking about, you almost have to devote a significant amount of resources to doing that function. So I almost wonder if some of what we're seeing is just a recognition of, yeah, we would like to do this, but we can't because it's too hard, too expensive, not worth it because we're not keeping the people. Explanations or excuses, take your pick. It's just not something that all organizations are willing to invest in.
I'd also add on the topic of sort of resources, time. I think there's something quite, you know, we live in a fast-paced world. The indicators of performance are on a certain pace. All of this human getting to know, observing the dynamics, this takes time. It takes time for them to unfold, to piece together the clues, to collect the evidence, to sort of, you know, also be in those situations where people properly open up to develop that level of trust. It feels like it's two kind of like two timings that do not match. And I think this perhaps is also something quite problematic for anybody who would like to engage in this type of approach in the workplace.
It's a difficult nut to crack because it is so context dependent. I mean, some organizations, certain organizations, like larger organizations, would seem to have this problem much greater than others. When I, you know, I've been going through a lot of YouTube videos recently, and of course, bashing corporate culture is a popular sport in those videos. And a lot of them are oriented on the larger organizations, who would seem to be the ones that would have the greatest amount of difficulty trying to institute this, simply because when you're talking about care, it's almost got to be programmed. It's got to be fair. It's got to be equitable across a very large number of people. There's a question that comes into my mind as to whether or not it's even tractable. You know, I can see how in a smaller organization, this would be something that would be manageable. But the size of the organization matter in this particular case.
So it's not necessarily, I think it's interesting. I would have actually, I think I would have the opposite kind of intuition, because larger organizations are usually more resourceful. So there you could have, you know, you have the numbers to justify investing in a program such as this and in informing skills like this. And you would have more resources to dedicate, you know, to hire people that whose only job is to observe and diagnose and create practice or programs that address the needs of the workers. Whereas in smaller organizations, you know, if you're lucky enough to have somebody that's supposed to be looking at this human aspect of the organization, it's usually a person that also has many other kind of functions and tasks. So they don't necessarily have, you know, the training or the time or the resources or the skills to pay attention and to try to understand this aspect.
I mean, if we look back at the organization that was object of this study, you know, this was a massive organization. So more than just the scale, it's perhaps a matter of ratio, right? So how many people can take care of how many, right? I think that's an important thing. But it's also interesting how, I don't know, maybe it's just fallen out of the priorities of certain companies, right? So you tend to either spread this element of care across individuals, you know, you have your mental health reference points, you have HR, you have certain people, maybe for different things, they're not all in one person. Or maybe it is all in one person, but at the same time, they've got other more sort of objective kind of things to accomplish. And it's just too much because there's an underestimation of how much time, you know, properly taking care of people can occupy at certain points. I don't know. I'm not sure. Can you scale care, basically? I don't know.
Well, it's a...
I'd like to believe so.
No, you're right. But it's the fact that this was a factory with, what, 20,000 workers, but the
29,000.
And the first relay assembly group was 5. The second one was 5. The mica splitting was 5. The bank wiring was like about 16 or 17, something like that. You know, so on the one hand, they were trying to get something that would be representative, or what they thought would be representative of the entirety of this organization. But they really were small. You know, these were small test samples, and there was a lot of resources put forth on this number of people. Even for the time, I wonder what it would have taken to follow those recommendations at Hawthorne. You know, one thing we didn't mention about the context, the bank wiring test was when the factory was starting to feel the direct effects of the depression. And there were concerns about whether that's the latter part of the study would be influenced by people worrying about getting laid off. And I think they ended up curtailing the study because there wasn't enough work for them to do, which was it didn't impact what they ultimately were looking for and how it, you know, and what their overall conclusions for their research was. It would have been interesting to hear, you know, if they had continued the study and looked at the effects of the depression and the laying off and all that sort of thing, how would they have operationalized their own recommendations at the end of the book?
Yes. And I think, I mean, we also need to kind of recognize the limitations, so to speak, of the study, which, you know, their whole focus is on, and the whole message at the end is saying human relations, a human aspect, the experiences of workers matter, and we should study them and diagnose them and kind of manage workers according to what we're finding. But there's not really a lot of ideas of, you know, what measures organizations might adopt to improve these experiences, right? Because it all depends on the workers themselves and of the social context, etc. And so I think, you know, I mean, their message is powerful. I totally believe and understand that it is important to look and to do this kind of, you know, diagnosing human situations, as they call it. But it does kind of leave the question of how, you know, what are the organization's abilities to answer to these human situations and demands, and, you know, what hopes do they have of actually improving them and improving that human aspect to go with the economic aspect of the organization.
I think also reflecting on sort of the era in which this is set, I think today we've got a far more sort of individualistic approach to, you know, taking care and sorting out. It's kind of on you as a worker, right? And if you're not happy, you move on. There's something also about, you know, where does the responsibility lie? And I think we are in a period where it lies more on us as individuals to seek out the solutions that work for us. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg one. But if you think about, you know, forming networks at work, or, I don't know, groups of a certain kind, managing your own work-life balance, enroll in an employee assistance program, seek out counseling support, and so on. It's really been sort of outsourced, whether you agree with it or disagree, or whether it actually comes from an ambition for an organization to sort this out, and then a realization that actually it's real difficult to kind of put forward some clean cuts and effective solutions. That's sort of another topic up for debate.
Yeah, this would be an interesting thing to get into. The more individual that this becomes, or the more on the individual that this becomes, does the nature of the complaints change? Because like here, when I went through those three levels or three types of expressions of dissatisfaction, the majority of them were of the tactile variety. Like, you could complain about something that you saw and touched, and it was very real to you and it was easy to complain about. Other experiences that were a bit more, you know, further and further afield from the work, that were a bit more abstract, involved interrelations or whatever, were more stressful, but they didn't, you know, quantitatively, they didn't dominate the complaints, and they tended to be confined within an individual. Now, if one's social relations, because we're individualistic, these workers were obviously in the organization for much, much longer than people typically stay in jobs nowadays. Is the stress increased because the complaints, the things that they're complaining about, are more abstract? There's less tactile there for them to grab hold onto. And so when everything's an abstraction, you don't know what to, you know, how to cope or how to deal with it. I know there are people looking at things like that, but of course, it doesn't help when you have things like office environments that take a lot of your, the building that we used to be, my current organization used to be and was famous for having its air conditioning work really well in the wintertime, and the heating was great in the summer. And that was all because of central thermostats. So the workers didn't have any way to, there was no window to open. So nobody could fight about opening windows.
But maybe anyway, there was camaraderie in complaining about the temperature, huh?
Well, yeah, that's
like a common cause.
Well, that is actually important. You know, there is something to be said about everybody complaining about the same thing. And, you know, and usually we have all sorts of great names to call the higher headquarters. None of them are particularly flattering. The we-they dynamic is, you know, it sort of has its place, I think, sometimes, you know, where you bind together that way against some unknown other so that you feel better about yourself and you are all sort of overcoming together. And the more individualistic you go, you don't have that to the same degree, do you? What else do we have?
Wondering whether we've missed anything.
But I'm wondering if we want to talk about, this is the ideal study. I mean, this is the type of a study that many of us would clamor for. The ability to do something in depth over a period of time and be able to adjust. And we were talking before about that these studies are impossible. What makes them impossible at this point? Like, what could be done to overcome the barriers to getting back into this level of a study? Because it would seem like with the way the kind of turmoil that we have nowadays in the workplace, you know, all of the big changes that we're seeing, in-depth studies like this would seem to be necessary, but they're so hard to do because they're expensive or whatever. But is it just because they're so hard and expensive and whatever, or is there something else?
I mean, it's, you know, besides the resources, I think one of them would be access, you know, having access to such a big organization for such a long period of time. Also the power of the researchers within the organization. I mean, here you see how it almost seems like they had complete control over, you know, coming up with new experiments and creating new divisions and training or retraining workers. And I mean, there's so much power that was given to the researchers to, you know, they begin by only kind of controlling or supervising five isolated workers, but they end up introducing changes that affect all of the 29,000 workers in the company. And then there's obviously also the kind of ethical dimension that we've mentioned at the beginning of, you know, how intrusive the study was at some point on the workers. which I think it would be very hard to get approval to do something like that today.
I'd also add the, apparently from the reading of the book, obviously, there seems to be no particular agenda. So it looks like the researchers went in, the research team went in, not with anything in particular in mind, but there was the possibility of maybe reaching some uncomfortable truths. And I think this is perhaps another part that would block the possibility of carrying out something similar. So, you know, if you went to sort of, you know, the big names that perhaps are on the headlines every so often because the workers are treated in a certain way, or it comes out afterwards, you know, could these be uncomfortable truths that could still be brought up more freely by a research team? I'm not sure.
Well, certainly we would never publish the name of the firm being studied. That by itself is something that's markedly different. You know, we always try to, nowadays, we take anonymity to its fullest extent. But even still, regardless of what happens, I think there's just the concern that the firms have about any bad news going out, because it just, you know, any bad news of any sort, it's a crisis. As it is, a lot of organizations are under siege because any bit of bad news hurts the bottom line and hurts it pretty quick in today's very fast-moving and information-driven environment. It's almost like what Gideon Kunda warned us back in his tech culture study, and how organizations try to control the prone to controlling worker behavior. They're risk-averse about such bad things coming out because somebody's going to figure it out. Put two and two together and say that was the firm studied, or even the insinuation that it was a particular organization could put the organization on the defensive. So nobody wants that kind of introspection anymore. Is that an overstatement or?
No, I agree with you. I think there are two things though, which I, you know, in thinking about doing a study like this now would be quite interesting. And one is that, you know, in this company, you have kind of very traditional professional roles, right? The engineer, the accountant, the chemist, and you have a kind of very nice division of labor. And, you know, I don't know if the picture would be different in today's firms. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that kind of, you know, they talk a lot about the importance of understanding where workers come from and what's their socialization even before they get into the firm, and how that affects, you know, each worker brings with them this socialization, and that, you know, adds something to the formation of the informal cultural, the informal organization. And, you know, even though, you know, at the beginning we said that they had workers from over 60 nationalities, I don't know if today's organizations, if we think about an organization of this size, being able to trace that context in which workers kind of grew up, et cetera, it's just way more complex, right? And then how everybody's so interconnected. And so, you know, if you take what they say to heart of how workers are affected by everything that's going on in their social context, and they bring that into the organization, I mean, it'll be so interesting to see what that looks like and what the implications of that are today, I think.
But would anybody be willing to wait 5 years for the results to come out?
Sure. I mean, good ethnographies can take up to 10 years, so why not? It will definitely have to be a study conducted in a team, which I think would be very nice.
But, yeah. Want to have any wrap-up or like concluding thoughts?
Sure. So I think my concluding thought would be, so two things. One kind of more academic reflection on, you know, our craft and how we do research. And I think this is a very good book to revisit today and to value and appreciate the transparency and the thoroughness of how the researchers narrate the research process or thought process, especially thinking about students. I think this is a very good resource to learn about the nature and the character of research and of good research, and how being open to consider, you know, I'm not finding what I thought I would be finding, but to then have the mind to go, okay, but why? What am I not paying attention to? And to kind of follow those intuitions and reflections could actually take you to be able to theorize and to discover things that are important and that we hadn't understood before. So I think in that sense, this book is fantastic. And on the other sense, which we've kind of mentioned before, particularly in this part two, just again saying something that maybe we thought was obvious, but then when we look at try to think of examples of organizations that are doing these, we can't think of any. But the importance of dedicating resources and time and personnel to look at to consider the experiences of workers and what they are saying about the way the organization is functioning and how it can function better. So those are the two things that I would take away from the book.
I would also add the rediscovery of the obvious, right? So this book in particular brings us back to what are good principles for the workplace. And I think as much as, you know, you read them and say, obviously you need breaks or a sort of a shorter working week, the reality of today's constantly interconnected, digital working from home, remote worker, precarious worker, the reality is that all of this is out the window, the rest breaks, the short working week, the possibility of, you know, not looking at emails on a Sunday or on a Saturday. And I think going back to the basics and recognizing that they are important and fundamental is one thing. Going also back to the basics of employees as human beings and not just work inputs, and the importance of, you know, the climate, the interpersonal relationships, the supervisory relationship. All of this is, yes, obvious. Yes, we know about it. But for 1001 reasons, they're not always there. We should not take them for granted. And perhaps a little bit of, you know, remembering that they should be there. And sometimes it depends on us as individuals to kind of put them in place. Is a welcome rediscovery, at least on my side.
My final takeaway is don't be afraid of large books. I mean, it is sometimes intimidating when, you know, especially those of us in academia, we do read a lot, or we are given a lot of stuff to read. But it really is good, you know, if we're going to go back to the classics, it is worth taking the time to really read the classic. And I know that's a message that we've been saying in this podcast quite a bit. This is another great example, because this is another work where you could follow the memes and see what people have summarized in, you know, in a single slide as like the main takeaway and save yourself the 600 pages or so. But there is so much to learn and to reflect on in the depth that this book went through that has caused me to rethink a lot of things that I know or have experienced or whatever. It was very much worth it. Although it took me reading it twice to be able to catch everything. It was a great classic to read, and I'm glad we tackled it. Glad we added it to our canon.
Yeah, it's sad to go and read a paper now. So short with a tiny method section.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.